Chapter 1. The Wind Cries Windy. To Windy, or to whom it won't concern. In 1999, in Austin, Texas, I wrote you a pop song as an alternative to hitting on you. It's taken me a while to deliver it. You wouldn't remember me. I wouldn't either. I was another faceless aphid, buzzing around you who knew what area of the bar you generally tended. There is a cassette tape I cannot find, a baby holy grail of self-awareness. I've asked several people if they might have it or a copy of it. I can practically feel its smooth, cool surfaces in my hands. A Memorex DBS 90-minute clear casing with blue, yellow, and pink highlights. Yellow reels and guide rollers. Write Protect tabs busted out, a wad of paper stuffed in the B-side for reasons I can't recall, a capstan hole of immeasurable sex metaphor, an amatory little thing, milky translucent from tender abuse and embryonic incubation of its attendant parts. In the crisp amber-hued fall of 1987, my high school compatriots Luis Delgado and Mandy Delgado, unrelated despite the surname, a fact Luis once clarified with theatrical flair, correcting a perplexed band director by enunciating Delgado, joined me and immortalized our youthful ambitions onto a Memorex DBS cassette. The A-side bore the crown jewel of our fledgling creativity, a song called Lorna. The night before, all three of us were at an East Central High School football game in San Antonio. All three of us played alto saxophone in the marching band, bound together by oddities like irony, the Beatles, cheerleaders, depression, French fries, and Zappa, self-designated outsiders in a cultural landscape being defined and molded by MTV, which, to give you an idea, means I had a tail and wore parachute red pants just 2 years prior. Lewis has always been a hard person to describe. If this project was optioned for film, he'd almost certainly be played by Hugo Reyes, Hurley from the series Lost. Hulking and soft-spoken, Lewis once referred to himself as a humanist scientist, a descriptor that encapsulated his biting intelligence and well-read nature. More on Lewis's character and his influence on my thoughts on music and expression later. That night at the football game, shivering in the stands, Lewis asked me for a pen. I always had one, usually for show, since I never carried anything to write on. He already had a post-it pad ready. Scribbling quickly, he handed me the note. It read, "Lorna, you got me torn up. Block that kick. Hold that line. Lorna, Lorna, you're so fine." Wendy, let me explain. Lorna was a cheerleader on whom I had an enormous, bulky crush. She, along with Jean Marie Model, another cheerleader Lewis crushed on, constituted the only reasons we were at that football game in the first place. Lorna was short, blonde with dark eyebrows, a trait shared by many Polish girls whose ancestry peppers the countryside southeast of San Antonio. She had a Wi-Fi foreshadowing smile, high cheeks, and the allure of a petite, semi-sweet kalashi, a pastry from Central Europe with fruit, filling nestled in puffy come-hither dough. The next day, a Saturday, I wanted to turn Lewis's words into a song. Lewis, having graduated the year before, had replaced his saxophone with a guitar and had been experimenting with a peculiar four-chord progression. The progression was laughably incomprehensible by traditional pop songwriting standards. The rhythm was equally odd, resembling the guitar lick in Louie Louie. It didn't occur to me at the time, but perhaps Lewis, given his name, was making a subconscious nod to the song. The progression itself offered no real opportunity for melodic development. It felt more Eastern than Western in its disregard for resolution. Okay, Wendy, let me interrupt myself. The fire alarm in the Morris County Library is going off. A few minutes before, there was an announcement made by a mousy librarian that they would be testing the alarm system for 4 minutes. Not worth mentioning here, except that the essential pitch of the alarm, according to my guitar tuning app, is A equals 220 and pulses rhythmically at a tempo of about 108 beats per minute, according to my metronome app, which means this very loud, strident sound I am experiencing rests effortlessly, both harmonically and rhythmically, upon the memory of the song I am writing to you about. Apps be damned, everything we do is music, said the 20th century composer John Cage. Okay, Wendy. During the fire alarm, I had an email exchange with Lewis about Lorna and his chords and his musical thinking. I asked him, I am considering that progression as being more Eastern than Western in terms of how vocal melodies needed to be shaped. Weren't you listening to a lot of George Harrison at the time? Do you remember what you were thinking when you came up with it? Is it satirical in any way? I mean, it breaks all the 1-4-5-4 rules. I'm on a personal quest to define my musical DNA. You naturally factor into it. He responded, simple. As with so many other things, I tend to purposely shuck the rule. If you listen to a bunch of my progressions, you'll notice a few things. They tease at a logical or traditional progression, but never quite go there. They sound like there are more different chords than there actually are. Just different voicings. B.B. King would slide to a note on one string and then pick the exact same note on the next string. Sometimes the progression is simply a shape on the fretboard or a natural feeling finger position. Often I try to achieve a tantric state combining the rhythm of the right hand, repetition without resolution, and open air as with suspended chords. I've seen a couple of live performance photos where I've apparently reached that zoned out state. Re-listen with this insight. Okay, Wendy, you may be wondering, what the hell does any of this have to do with me? Or when and where will this wandering squander make land? Or what's your name again? Where did we meet? It was the Ginger Man in Austin, Texas. You were working on a degree in architecture. I'm getting there. By the time Lewis and Mandy arrived at my house, I had already been tinkering with a low-budget way to record this thing. My parents had a Technics cassette tape deck that had 2/4-inch inputs on the front of it, a truly impractical feature unless you wanted to do something as irregular and ill-advised as what we were about to do. My father had a Fender Twin Reverb amplifier that he used when he played with the band he was in at the time, Anarchist Convention. The plan was to have Lewis play an acoustic guitar directly into the amplifier using an acoustic pickup. I would then send the output of the amp directly into one of the 2 1/4-inch inputs of the cassette deck, effectively sending his guitar exclusively to one channel, or side, of the cassette. I had a shitty dynamic microphone that I would send into the other channel exclusively. In short, a two-track recording. There was a silent, sympathetic sense that we were congealing, a hatchling band, incubating in the heat of the glowing orange tubes of a Fender amp. And what was Mandy doing just standing there without an instrument or a channel to record into? The only thing he could do, beat on the amplifier rhythmically with a pair of maracas I had, equally inciting the reverberation coils of the amp and coming through the shitty mic I was singing into. Now that is a scene to behold. Three misfit teens huddled around an amp, making some very strange, very personal music. Filling a Memorex DBS 90-minute tape with several versions of a song called Lorna. A dark, brooding dirge of a tune, extremely primitive in nature, that embodied humor, satire, and something more elusive and non-Western. Incubating and pecking through a shell and into what we be a very colorful 11-year relationship with the Delgados as the alternative rock band, the Robertsons. Indeed, a memoir by the Robertsons would be a good read. It would be replete with all of the customary politics and drama of the countless band memoirs that are already out there, but told as a cautionary tale of what happens when nothing ever happens and nobody ever does anything. We named ourselves after Pat Robertson, the televangelist, to spite his 1988 bid for the U.S. presidency. Okay, Wendy. So, in 1999, 13 years after the recording of the song Lorna, I already had an embarrassing amount of experience writing songs as ways to avoid the embarrassment of hitting on girls. In 1999, 2 years after the disbandment of the Robertsons, I was doing graphic design for a healthcare company in Austin, and already knee-deep in the habit of writing a bunch of songs about girls and drinking. In fact, the song I wrote for you is the second of a suite of Bartendra songs, along with Kalita, 1998, named after a bartendress at the Liberty Bar in San Antonio, and Miss Tune, 1999, for a girl at the Ritz in Austin. Footnote: at the time of Miss Tune and others I wrote in quick succession, I would spend several Thursdays in a row at the Ritz, where the Tosca Tango Ensemble would play matinees. Also, the exceptional Belgian ale, Duvel, was ridiculously underpriced at $2 a bottle. Tosca Tango and Tosca, the internal string quartet of the ensemble, will continue to factor heavily into the narratives of this project and will be explored in the chapter and song, The Idiot and the Oddity. At the time, I was rooming with Chuck Fisher, best man at my wedding and the last, best, and most dedicated drummer of the Robertsons. I had a Brussels Griffon named Nicholas, a conflation of nucleus and ridiculous, that had a bark that sounded more like a tropical bird. He was tiny and one of the middle school kids we used to play basketball with at our apartment complex noted, and in an exaggerated southern drawl, "Your dog looks just like a penis." Nick's bark was the very first sound heard as a downbeat before the original song I wrote for you began. The song I burned to a CD and never gave to you. Wendy. The night I met you, the Ginger Man was jam-packed with yuppies, lawyers, and grad students. The jukebox was slamming stuff like Radiohead's The Bends and Tom Waits's Mule Variations. Wedging into a space to order a beer in your area of the bar was thorny. Knowing well that a person like you must get all imaginable manner of shallow advances from boys sloshing with stuff pouring from the wall behind you, I attempted something I thought would be meta-valiant. I'll have a Meredith Sue 8 and your ring finger size. For context, dear listeners, Maredsu 8 is an exceptional Belgian ale that remains the best I've ever tasted. I haven't been able to find it anywhere for about 10 years. Wendy measured sips on the ordered beer and shouted above hipster jukebox small talk followed. Your architecture studies, my graphics and music, etc. By the end of the pint, your interest in my sales pitch had both fizzled out, like a candle pinched out by a wrangler who just blew into town to do precisely that and only that. I went straight home and wrote and recorded The Wind Cries Wendy in a crystal-fevered marathon from 11 p.m. to 11 a.m. Here's an excerpt of the end product of that restless address of leftovers and longing, composed on a Mac G3, in the software Cubase. It's a demo. Nothing ever really is anything else for me. And as a reminder, the first thing you hear next is my dog, Nicholas, barking just after and before another bite at my ankle, on a perfect downbeat as I track some half-assed vocal tracks.
Listen, I can see your point. This sort of thing must happen to you all the time. It goes with the architecture or the territory. I want to know whether this will suffice. Of course I know what you mean. I mean, how could you know if it wasn't just the sauce talking? And the bridge I'm burning to walk across must be littered with the hearts of the less worthy than me.
The Wind Cries Wendy stands for me as an autobiographical reflection on the earliest intersections of ethanol and aesthetics. Yet I'm deliberately leaving out how this intersection played out during the tumultuous time when The Scientist was composed. In 1999, the night after I met you at the Ginger Man, I didn't analyze the why. I simply acted. I acted on your eyes, your unshakable presence, and your strength in avoiding my advances. So here it is, whoever you are, the current mix of your song and only your song. Trust me, this is the only way I know how to handle this moment. Here are the lyrics, recited as poetry, by a real scientist.
Listen, I can see your point. This sort of thing must happen to you all of the time. It goes with the architecture and the territory. I want to know, girl, whether this'll suffice. Of course I know what you mean. I mean, how could you know if it wasn't just the sauce talking? And the bridge I'm burning to walk across must be littered with the hearts of the more worthy than me. The air in the horns, all around the strings, and in between, all along these vocal cords, silent, still, and weeping incessantly. And then the wind cries. Okay, so I'm a flying buttress, simply supporting the weight of the world, unable to retrace myself because I was flying. Yeah, that's right. Is this good enough? How about this? The air in the horns, all around the strings, and in between, all along these vocal cords, silent, still, and weeping incessantly. And the wind cries, Wendy! Check it. I want to do something. I say that with blood level, on a scale from none to bum. So if your bargain holds, as this jargon goes, this fly seductor will bust a juxtapose.
Listen, I can see your point. This sort of thing must happen to you all of the time. It goes with the architecture and the territory. I
just the sauce talking and the bridge I'm burning to walk across must be littered with the hearts of the more worthy than me. The air in the horns all around the strings and in between all along these vocal cords silent still and weeping incessantly and then
so I'm a flying buttress, merely absorbing the weight of the world. Yet, I've been able to retrace my steps because I was flying. Yeah, that's right. Is this good enough? How about this?
The air in the horns all around the streets. From none to bum. So if your bargain holds, as this jargon grows, this fly seductor will bust a juxtapose.